You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Time now for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about an iconic building in eastern Wisconsin.
On the western coast of Lake Michigan sits the city of Manitowoc, a place known for its deep connection with the water. And along its shore, a lighthouse, essential to the area's maritime history, stands tall, watching over the city. Molly Hunkin climbed inside to take us on a tour.
Okay, well, welcome to Manitowoc North Breakwater Lighthouse. You're about half a mile out in the lake here. Ludington is about 60 miles across the lake, straight over here. So you're out in the center of things here.
Paul Reckel is a member of Manitowoc Sunrise Rotary, a locally based group which organizes fundraising events for the community. Within the past decade, they have also become the official caretakers of the Manitowoc North Breakwater Lighthouse. The lighthouse was built in 1918, making it over 100 years old. Its name comes from the structure that it's built on.
When you walked out here on the concrete, that's the breakwater. And basically what that is, it separates the lake from the harbor, and it makes a safe place for the ships to come in and be protected.
The building itself has 5 stories. Its first floor is a basement, which used to act as storage and a boathouse. In this portion of the basement was a dory, a small boat which lighthouse keepers used for rescues.
But you can read stories on it where the lighthouse keepers in its day would take care of the rescues out on the lake when they occurred. And even in the middle of winter, tremendous blizzard, at night, no lights, they had to listen to the sounds and actually push the boat out, hop in it, and go out and rescue the people and then bring it back in.
On the second floor, the motor room housed the motor to generate power for the light on top. Above that sits the watch room, where lighthouse keepers used radio equipment to keep in touch with boats out on the lake. In cases of stormy weather, sometimes lighthouse keepers stayed overnight in cots in this room, though they normally slept on shore. The diaphone room on the fourth floor used to be the location of the foghorn, also called a diaphone. Ships could activate the diaphone from the lake to warn of their arrival on shore. From the deck outside, you can see the Badger Car Ferry, which has been running since the 1950s, beginning its round trip between Manitowoc and Ludington, Michigan.
That's two toots like that, that's a salute to us. Thank you.
After a brief climb up a small metal ladder, you reach what most people would think of when imagining a lighthouse, the lens house.
That's where the light that signals to the ships is located. And this particular light could be seen from 17 miles out in the lake, which is by no means...
The small room on top of the lighthouse holds no more than the light itself, with enough space for a few people around it. The expansive view looks out over Lake Michigan and the city of Manitowoc. After the need for lighthouse keepers disappeared, the building became run down. It succumbed to vandalism and the wear and tear expected for a building in the middle of a lake. But in 2011, the Manitowoc North Breakwater Lighthouse was put on auction by the Coast Guard. It was purchased by a man from Long Island, New York, named Philip Carlucci, for $30,000.
When you buy a property from the Coast Guard, you have to bring it up to standards and maintain it. So he stuck over $325,000 into it to get it in the condition it is in today.
The owner and Manitowoc Sunrise Rotary are collaborating with the Wisconsin Maritime Museum, also located in Manitowoc, to return historical objects and equipment to the building. Looking forward, the owner hopes to continue restoring the lighthouse to its original state.
Molly Hunkin brought us that story on the Manitowoc Breakwater Lighthouse. The building itself is part of the Wisconsin 101 Project, which tells our state's history through objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, our broadcasting license from the FCC doesn't allow us to curse on the radio, but swearing is more acceptable in some workplaces than others. You might not want to swear at your boss, but it might be less of a big deal if you drop a profanity around a trusted coworker. Cursing has long been viewed as unprofessional or inappropriate, but it's become more commonplace in other environments as social and cultural norms have changed. Timothy Jay is Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. He's the author of 6 books on cursing, language, and inappropriate behavior. He's a widely cited expert on swearing. I talked to him earlier this year. Now, what is it? You've done a lot of work on swearing and cursing. What is it about swearing that, as a psychologist, you find so interesting?
Well, it's the speakable taboo. We're not supposed to do it, but everybody knows how to swear. And children know how to swear. So it's the one kind of language you learn very early on, but you're not allowed to use it. And I think it's the taboo nature of it. It's that, you know, that the edge of proper language, and you're like, where is that line? Where is it appropriate? What does it tell us about people and how they interact? How are cultures different? How does the brain mature to do this? There's so many questions that are interesting to me as a scientist that every time I found the answer to one question, a dozen more would pop up. That's why it's interesting to me.
Now, there's a handful of common words that might pop to mind when we think of cursing and swearing. What is it that leads a word to be promoted or demoted, however you want to think of it, to one of those words?
Well, it's all convention. These are all standards that have evolved over centuries, and they have mainly to do with religion, sexuality, relationships with ancestors, animal names, and sort of disgusting things that come out of your body. Those cover even globally, the categories of words that become taboo. And the English-speaking countries, these words have been fairly stable for years. The four-letter words, these are 1,000 years old. So these are conventions or standards that are passed on from generation to generation. And they're policed by what I call the institutions of power. Like religion, education, mass media all have standards. And the fact that these institutions of power punish people or reprimand people for using these language makes them remain powerful.
We're talking to Timothy Jay, psychologist expert on swearing and taboo language. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your thoughts on the use of profane language. Do you see more of it than you used to? Where is it appropriate? Is it ever appropriate? What do you think? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to talk about context in which we use these words, Timothy. In my job on the radio, if I use certain words, I'm subjecting our station to potentially very big fines and me getting fired. If I use a profanity, say, at band practice, I might be, I don't know, building solidarity with the guys. Can you talk about the importance of context in determining when and where we say these words?
Yeah, that's the examples you gave are good. Context is the end all and the be all of using this kind of language. What a word means, how offensive it is, depends entirely on context, the who, what, where, and when. And as these variables shift, whether language is appropriate, offensive language is appropriate or not, it also shifts.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Morgan is with us in Eau Claire. Morgan, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for this. It really caught my attention just because I have a 5-year-old and she loves to express herself. I will, you know, occasionally say, you know, the 4-letter swear word, but like more like in excitement or just more to express myself. And I've noticed just as she gets older, she'll say it kind of just more casually than maybe some people would be comfortable with. So I guess just my question was, do you feel like that is something that is okay for her to be able to express? Or I guess I'm not sure what the line is between it being appropriate or being not appropriate.
Morgan, thanks. You're talking to a guy who wrote a book called What to Do When Your Kids Talk Dirty. What would you tell her, Timothy?
Yeah, every parent should anticipate this. By the time the kids go off to school, they probably have a vocabulary of about 40 different words that they've learned from their listening to their parents, and to their friends. They might use these kind of words more with their friends than around their parents. But I think that's a great occasion for you, Meredith, to express your family values. And I think the best thing is to remain cool. You know, don't overreact. That only makes the words more powerful and gives the kids the, I can push mom's buttons with these words. Remain cool. Ask them about their emotions. You know, like, why are you using this word? Are you angry? You know, you can also just say, I'm angry. But I think you want to keep the door open as a mother to talk about not only words, but also what's going to happen in a few years as the sexual terms will come in. And you don't want to be repressive about that. You know, you want to be, if you want to communicate your values about religion or sexuality, I think that's your role as a parent. So anticipate it, be cool about it, but if you have rules about this, then if the kid breaks the rule, then there are consequences. So I think it's an integral part of parenting. But what surprised me in the psychological literature, especially developmental psychology, there was no mention of this in scientific literature. That's why one of the reasons why I wrote the book, What to Do When Your Kids Talk Dirty, is every parent knows this is important. And also, besides the four-letter words, it's like, how do I talk about my body? How do I talk about the things that come out of my body? You know, how does my family talk about these things? So take that as a role as a parent and as an educator to teach values to your daughter.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story. We're talking to psychologist Timothy Jay with the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts about cursing and the cultural norms around naughty words. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about swearing? Do you think people should let loose and say what they want? When, where, what environment is the right time to swear, if any? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation, hear from some more of you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Timothy Jay, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, author of many books on the subject of cursing and swearing. He's with us today to talk about why we swear, how different social environments affect the language we use. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Bob is with us in the Beloit area. Bob, hello.
Why, hello. So I just wanted to bring this up. My mom is going to be 101 in March, still living at home, and she started a cussing club probably when she was in her 80s. And her theory behind it was to bring all the friends and people over. They could come in, they could cuss, they could get everything out of their system. And she kind of thought that people, when they got older with dementia, then wouldn't be doing that as much because they felt free to get that out at this point. I just thought that was a interesting vision, and there's no scientific evidence behind it, obviously, but I'm curious about what your speaker's thoughts are on that.
Well, and Bob, I gotta ask, have you been to one of these, or were you not invited as you know, a kid, not one of the peers?
I was not invited. This was something my mom did with her a bunch of her lady friends, and primarily started because one of her friends was getting dementia and was starting to cuss and use some languages. And this made her feel more comfortable bringing her in and doing social functions when everybody could come in and just
Bob, that is super interesting. Thanks for sharing that. Timothy, I'm gonna guess there may not be a lot of research on this, but what do you think about that idea?
Yeah, I think it's also part of what we're seeing now, more women swearing generally as more women are in the workplace, more women in public. Sort of a more empowerment of women to use this, what I would call powerful language. Certainly, if you're going to work in a high pressure context like a law firm, the women in the law firm are going to pick this up. But with regard to aging, although I can never imagine my mother doing this, I was raised in a very religious family. I never heard my mother swear, although my father was a bricklayer and I heard him swear, especially at work. But we have studied cursing in nursing homes. And what he reported is happening. What is happening is there, in a nursing home, you have sort of, with dementia, you have a reversion to childhood. And the people with dementia become very childlike. They're not as careful about their bath habits. And they revert to the emotional language of childhood. If the person is bilingual, they usually will revert to swearing in their native language. But this is common in nursing home settings, especially in the dementia wings, and where you will see them using the language of their childhood. So what we recorded about 20 years ago in the nursing homes was we didn't have the offensive language that teenagers use now. It was mainly profanity, words like Jesus, damn, goddamn, words like that. It will be interesting to see when the younger generation reaches the nursing home and has dementia. I would imagine the kind of language we'll hear in another 40 or 50 years is going to be a lot worse now. But the use of profanity during dementia is common, along with other sort of childlike behavior.
Bob, thanks for sharing that story. Tom is with us now in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I have a question for your guest. I'm under the impression that a lot of swear words covering taboo subjects, the culture, whatever the culture it is that's using those words, they tend to borrow the words from other cultures. For one's own culture, it's demeaning to use words to cover perhaps sexual subjects, and so you borrow words from other cultures.
Tom, interesting. Thanks. Timothy, is that something that we use loan words for some of these ideas?
Well, I think of the lexicon of swearing like a garden, and there are some plants in there that are ancient, and like the F word and the S word. Those words have been around for 1,000. They grew up in Anglo-Saxon culture, but also influenced by German and Italian. So there is some borrowing. Where I see that obviously today is the expansion of hip hop culture around the world, globally, where you have people that are saying American swear words that they pick up in hip hop from music and other genres of hip hop. And they, you know, it's common to hear this in Sweden or Germany or Switzerland, to hear swear words being appropriated. This is happening now more than ever because of the global expansion of entertainment media and film and music, but also the internet.
Tom, thanks a lot for bringing that up. Interesting point. Talking to Timothy J., psychologist, expert on swearing. Back to your calls. Adam was with us in River Falls. Hi, Adam.
Hi. Yeah, interesting topic. Growing up on a farm, there was lots of cursing down in the barn when things did not go well, but my mom made sure we did not use those words in the house. So my question is, how much control do we have over these words? And as I'm raising little boys now, and you mentioned kids earlier on, are there any tactics in helping make sure that those words don't come up or aren't used as much as they can be?
Well, I think on that last note, I think you should expect them to come up. Every competent speaker of English knows all these swear words. I think what you need to engage them is in a discussion of etiquette. Language has styles, like clothing has styles, and where you learn where it's appropriate and where it's not appropriate. I had the same kind of division of labor in my house where What happened at work was different than what happened at the dinner table. And I think by the time boys are adolescents, they need to learn that what you can say in the backyard, what you can say in the barn is different than what you can say at work or at school. That's just part of, you know, learning your culture. And I think sometimes, like when things go wrong anywhere in the barn or on the golf course or at work, and we become frustrated, it seemed to be there's sort of a natural reflexive use of this, like the hammer on the thumb idea. So that kind of stuff, I think, is a habit which is kind of drilled into you or that you've practiced enough that it becomes almost automatic. Whereas other times, I think answering the question about control is a matter of, should I use this kind of language or tell this kind of joke in this situation? And there's where it's not like the hammer on the thumb. It's more like what I call strategic use of this. Like, that's not a good idea to say that here. Or maybe I should say that here because I'm angry.
Adam, thanks for that call. And Timothy, thanks again for joining us today.
As I said, I'm darn glad to be here and tell your listeners to support public radio. I do.
Timothy Jay is professor of psychology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts and author of many books on swearing, including Why We Curse. I talked to him earlier this year about changing norms of swearing, especially in the workplace. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, kids in school face a lot of pressure to perform in academics and activities. Has it gone too far? Meet the author of the new book, Never Enough, When Achievement Culture Becomes Toxic and What We Can Do About It. And it's apple season. A Wisconsin historian shares the unique history of the fruit here in the state and beyond. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, John Grisham, George R.R. Martin, and other high-profile authors are suing the creators of so-called artificial intelligence programs for scanning and then imitating their works. Find out what's at stake for the creative world and the books we read. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. If you like to read fiction, think about your favorite author, one you'd read like anything and everything they wrote. Now suppose a computer algorithm scanned all of that too and then wrote its own book in the style of your favorite author. Would you want to read it? Would you be glad to have more? Or would you be offended at the computer imitation? These are not really hypothetical questions anymore. Last week, a group of 17 best-selling authors brought a class action lawsuit against OpenAI, creator of the ChatGPT chatbot. The authors, including names like John Grisham and George R.R. Martin, say that OpenAI used their copyrighted works to train ChatGPT without their permission. The lawsuit also claims that programs like ChatGPT harm the writing industry as a whole, making it harder for writers to earn a living wage. Similar claims have come up in the Writers Guild of America strike. That group represents writers in Hollywood and other media industries. That was an issue in the months-long writer's strike, which may end after a tentative deal announced today. Our next guest thinks a lot about so-called artificial intelligence and what it means for humans, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this idea of artificial intelligence programs being trained on copyrighted works by authors, real authors, without their permission? Are you optimistic or worried about how these chatbot programs could transform reading and writing? Would you want to read that hypothetical, not so hypothetical AI-authored book that imitates your favorite writer? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Robin Zabrowski is an AI theorist and professor of cognitive science at Beloit College. Robin, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Artificial intelligence and these chatbots and large language models and all these other things in some ways seem to have come out of nowhere, Robin, and they're suddenly transforming so many different lines of work, including creativity and, yes, writing. Can you talk a little bit about how this became such a big part of our culture and opened up so many questions?
Yeah, so they haven't really come out of nowhere. We've had the technology that does this for decades. They're not wildly different than the expert systems and neural nets we had in the 1980s. What's really different is the ability of folks to gather giant data sets. So before we had all of the various ways that our data is sucked up everywhere in the real world and online, there wasn't enough data in order to train these things to be that good. But now that we have these large data sets, I mean, this is exactly how we get ChatGPT out of almost nowhere. It's a lot.
Now let's get into authoring books here. Let's go with George R.R. Martin, because one of the cases they give in this lawsuit is ChatGPT was able to output an outline of a prequel to his Song of Ice and Fire called A Dawn of Direwolves, using actual characters he created, things like that. Would a book by a chatbot that read all of George R.R. Martin's books be a George R.R. Martin book, if I can get philosophical?
I certainly don't think so. I think that I haven't actually read George R.R. Martin, but I feel like his books probably have some, you know, like they introduce new things. And that's really important. Sometimes I have a writer that I'll read for decades and I'll love most of their work, and then they'll take a different turn and I'll be like, it's not quite as good, but like, I get why they don't want to write the same thing for their entire lives. Importantly, these bots that do this, they're not exactly doing something new. They're just taking the structures about things like stories that they've learned, and then, of course, the language and something like the style from the George R.R. Martin books that were in the training set, and just kind of putting them in a blender and spitting them back out. I have very little interest in books like written like that. I'm much more interested in the actual authors writing things.
Now, this comes up because of this lawsuit we mentioned, and there are others from authors against the companies behind these ChatGPT and other chatbots. So this is getting into the legal world here. It seems like we have a legal system that determines if, you know, if I started writing a book using characters that somebody else created that were still under copyright, well, I know that I'd be accused of plagiarism, and rightly so. How much does this chatbot concept shake things up in the legal world, do you think?
I think part of the problem is that we've known that things like this were coming for a long time, and there's been a branch of AI ethics, right? People thinking about these problems and anticipating them for decades. Back in the 90s, when I was in graduate school, there were people doing AI ethics way before we had AI. And I think the most depressing thing about the current moment is that nobody listened to any of them. Because like we could have predicted things like this would happen. And we tried to get people to anticipate this with law, and just nobody took any of it very seriously. And I think the legal part is still really messy. I think it probably is of a type with like fan fiction, right? On the one hand, I think that people being allowed to write fan fiction is awesome. But I know that there have been big legal battles mm-hmm. with fan fiction communities as well. And I think that this is similar, but somehow different, although putting my finger on exactly how it's different is really tricky.
Another part of the story here is, okay, if I'm running a company designing some sort of chatbot, I'm looking for that big data you mentioned. I'm running all this material I found on the internet, and well, it includes novels by these authors, and I didn't ask them if I could do this. Is that wrong of me? Should I have gotten permission first?
Yeah, it seems like uncontroversially true to me that it was not correct of them to do this. Probably they did it in part because they didn't realize how successful the product would be. And because there's lots of like cobbling data sets together around what's publicly available all over people working on neural networks. I just think they didn't realize what would happen if the product was as successful as they hoped it would be. But as soon as you realize that, like right after ChatGPT was released to the public, Microsoft handed them $10 billion. Like they had to realize they could not be profiting off all this work that wasn't theirs.
We are talking about so-called artificial intelligence programs, how they use copyrighted work by existing authors, and artists and other creative types, by the way. You could join in with your thoughts on all this, your questions, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you used a chatbot of some sort for, I don't know what, to write a paper, a first draft, to do a report for work, to make a, I don't know, an image for a pamphlet or an ad or something, join in at 800-642-1234. Robin, authors aren't the first people to raise these concerns. We've seen stories about artists also, because there's a lot of things you can go to online to say, hey, make me an image of blank, blank, and blank. And wow, these online things are pretty good at creating images, except the artists say, well, they're good at it because they scan in lots of works by existing artists in the first place.
Yeah, I remember not that, I can't remember exactly when, but yeah, Sarah Anderson of Sarah's Scribbles, which is just a really fabulous webcomic, and two other artists brought a lawsuit against, who was it, Stability AI and Midjourney, and I think DeviantArt, all to say our work was stolen and used to train these machines, which now are directly putting us out of work. Right. So lots of places that were already grudgingly paying artists for their work now can just do things in the style of these artists. And they don't have to pay anyone to do that. And it seems so deeply problematic in the same way that sort of George R. R. Martin and all the other people on the author lawsuit are noticing that it's like, you know, directly affecting their bottom line.
I want to talk about the nature of these ChatGPT and other similar concepts and programs and algorithms. I think when we look at the output we get from them, it's easy to think, oh, they're creative. They write like people or draw like people or whatever. The linguist Emily Bender wrote about artificial intelligence as a stochastic parrot and warned that we shouldn't attribute creativity or intentionality to these kind of programs. I'm guessing these are things you've thought about a lot. What do you think?
Yeah, the Stochastic Parrots paper shook the AI ethics world up a lot when it was released. It set off this ridiculous storm where two of the authors were fired from Google for writing it, even though it was their job. They were employed by Google as AI ethicists. And so they're supposed to be anticipating and pointing out ways that the company may not be performing ethically. And one was just a very public firing. Tim McGabrew basically got fired on Twitter for being one of the authors of this paper. And I think the paper was brilliant in part because the stochastic parrot's imagery is just wonderful, right? The idea that it is parroting the text and the ideas and the structures of language that it's been fed, but it's also just sort of mixing them up enough to look like something new. And it's not new. It's maybe not direct plagiarism, but it's absolutely just sort of shaking up all the text it's been given and spitting it out based on a probability, how likely one word is to follow another.
We're talking to Robin Zabrowski, an AI theorist and professor of cognitive science at Beloit College. We're talking about a group of prominent authors bringing a lawsuit against OpenAI, the makers of ChatGPT, and what it all means for creativity and the books we read. You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Do you enjoy reading? If so, are you worried about text maybe being written by artificial intelligence programs? Are you a writer? How has AI impacted you in your profession? Have you played around with any of these so-called AI chatbots of one sort or another? Played or worked with one? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Robin Zabrowski, professor of cognitive science at Beloit College, about a lawsuit brought against OpenAI by a group of prominent authors, including George R. R. Martin and Jonathan Franzen, many others saying, hey, you scanned our works without getting permission, and now your programs can output things like our works without our permission. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to hearing about that suit? What is your take on AI generating more of what we read? Will it free up humans to do other things, or will it be worse off? If you are a creative type yourself, are you worried about some of these artificial intelligence creations? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Deborah's with us in Madison. Deborah, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
Well, I use chat. I'm a freelance blogger, and I do that for some small companies. And I use ChatGPT to put together a blog, and it came up with a great title, great lead-in paragraph, was pretty much empty of content that was, you know, really had any substance to it. But I can see that very soon the machine will learn enough to be able to come up with good blogs, and soon companies won't need people like me that are just making, you know, money just writing these blogs for people. And so I think very soon freelancers like me will be out of a job.
Deborah, do you think there are things that you, Deborah, bring to the table that, you know, are unique and that maybe would be hard to replace with another person or with a chatbot or what have you?
I think that...
Oh, I'm sorry, we're losing the line, Deborah. But Robin, Deborah's point well taken. She provides a service now. She sees maybe it's not quite there yet, but she sees a time when companies might just use these programs instead of going to her.
Yeah, I mean, this is already happening, right? We're seeing lots of newsrooms that are laying off journalists to do exactly this. And we also saw a lot of this happen recently where, I don't want to badmouth a particular network, but somebody basically fired a department and deployed stories written by ChatGPT, and within days had to suspend that because the stories were factually incorrect, poorly written, and had to walk a whole bunch of stuff back. So I think that on the one hand, we shouldn't overestimate the power of these things. They can give some convincing but factually disastrous results. But also I would hope that Deborah in her job is not using these tools, because all that's going to do is help automate her out of a job. Because I'm pretty sure OpenAI is clear in their terms of service that the ways that you use this service are then getting fed back in to train new models. So I would encourage many of my writer and artist friends not to participate, because you're scabbing, basically. You're going to work yourself out of a job.
Deborah, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. That reminds me of a couple of stories I've seen, Robin. A lawyer using a chat program to come up with a legal brief that looked just right and the format was great and it referred to legal precedents that had never, ever existed. Concerns from a mushroom foraging society that there were books showing up on Amazon, clearly written by artificial intelligence, with bad information about which mushrooms are safe, which doesn't sound good to me. I mean, is there going to be a point where we realize we set standards for how much human oversight there has to be on something we create with these?
That's a really good question. Yeah, I think that the ways that it is factually incorrect just belies the fact that most people don't understand how these systems work. They're never going to be like truth-telling systems. The way they're designed is they have to have taken in so much text that they can spit out reasonable appearing responses, but there's absolutely nothing about the code that would ever enable the guarantee that they are factual in any way. And I just think this is deeply problematic, right? Because I know that the Writers Guild recently started, I think it's not official, but they think they reached a settlement, and the AI stuff was a big sticking point. Because it's happening all over, where people are just hiring writers to fix the factual pieces that are all broken. And it just seems so problematic. And it's a part of the technology, like it's an inherent part of how the technology works, that there is not a way for it to be guaranteed factual. And we've seen some of that go very badly. That poor lawyer who had no idea how the technology worked, because OpenAI released it with no instruction of exactly what it's doing. And so lots of people are fooled into thinking that it's not just grammatical, but that it's factually correct.
Talking to Robin Zabrowski from Beloit College about the various chatbots, OpenAI programs out there, the ethical issues they're raising. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Another issue, Robin, is that, okay, we've got these, I think, artificial intelligence style programs optimizing our search results, saying, okay, here's what I'm going to show you first when you search for, I don't know, recipe for zucchini or whatever. And then other people writing their blogs and whatnot to capture the attention of that. Are we going to get this feedback loop where we're our artificial intelligence programs are writing things to be detected by other artificial intelligence programs?
Yes. And I think it's already happening. Like I've seen in the past, maybe 6 months or so, lots of people sort of bemoaning the loss of Google search. I don't know how much you use it, but if you use Google search now, the results just seem worse than they used to be.
Definitely.
Google sort of stole the whole market by having the best algorithm back in the early days. But it's just unreliable, and it's so bloated by people who pay to increase their rankings, and it's just not very useful anymore. And it's only going to be a bigger problem. And in fact, there are folks who think we've hit as good as these chatbots will ever get, in part because they're trained on so much of the internet. And now that so much of the internet is being populated by AI generated text, we're going to start seeing this messiness emerge, and it's going to get worse and worse.
Another concern I know, Robin, is the ability to produce misinformation in volume. If I want to start a misinformation campaign, I could by hand create a bunch of social media accounts and then by hand type up things and paste them in. Well, now I can have a whole bunch of different OpenAI programs with different photos attached to them and maybe even slightly different personalities flooding every comment section and social media outlet in the world.
Yeah, and I think we are seeing some of that. It's funny. We think like we don't want them to put artists and writers out of work, but then you hear about, you know, like the enormous troll farms that are peddling disinformation around the world. And we kind of do want to put them out of work, except the result is still that much misinformation all over the place. And I do think that the way these systems were released, and this is really on those companies for having done it this way, but I think that it's sort of like the cat is out of the bag. It's really hard to backtrack now that the code is out there, and that, yes, like we can produce misinformation at wild scales that was not possible before.
Time for one more caller. Don is with us in Madison. Don, hello.
Yeah, hi. So I just had a comment. So I have five kids, and two are in high school and three are in college. And when this, you know, AI came out a couple, you know, a year ago, I'd actually use it to try to like, you know, help them in some ways. And at first it seemed like a good idea, but then what we would find, especially with college stuff, is that AI would think it knew something that was factual and it would write something to help us. And then we'd actually fact check it against what we were learning in the class. And it was not, you know, many times it was inaccurate. So we ended up just totally giving up on even, you know, utilizing it. I do think that AI has been helpful for my children, at least, not to write papers for them, but to give them suggestions on how to write specific, like they're trying to figure out how to write something specifically. And I've noticed not necessarily that their work is, you know, AI-like, but that they've learned how to frame things in papers better than they used to.
Don, thanks a lot for the call. We just have a few moments left, Robin. Your thoughts on AI and education, big issue with just a few moments left.
Yes, huge issue. I think that the caller is absolutely right that it can give people who are in some way especially disadvantaged second language learners, it can be a real benefit to help them understand the structure of writing. But he's hit it right on the head that it's such a disaster factually that I think there are a lot of students using it and getting bad grades as a result because they're just not anywhere near the realm of reality.
Thanks for that call, Don. And Robin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Robin Zabrowski, an AI theorist and professor of cognitive science at Beloit College. We've been talking about a new lawsuit brought against the makers of ChatGPT by a bunch of big-name authors and how artificial intelligence is changing the game for writers and many others as well. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network.